FM。It is 18 hours, 29 minutes and 53 seconds, East African time, time for John Sibi Okumu on Wednesday. This being Wednesday, the 12th of April, 2023. Hamjambo na karibuni. Hello and welcome. Come December the 12th this year, Kenya will be 60 years old. Much will be made of it, and for good reason. Now, in all that time, the understanding is that politically, we have adopted constitutionalism, that is, a political order governed by laws and regulations. The thing is, we have not had the same constitution throughout. Our constitution, the supreme law of the land, has changed significantly twice. With the independence of 1963 constitution being changed first in 1969 and then again in 2010. But in between, there were any number of amendments. Now, there's an obvious question there. Why the changes? My guest, a mystery at first, as usual, is a constitutional lawyer and in the past was a university lecturer in law. And she is bound to put me straight as a representative of all one Aenchi everywhere in my likely ignorance. Starting with the present, I'd like her to listen to answers from the road or the street or wherever to the question, what do you like best about our new constitution, 2010?
I cannot comment because I've never read it. I'm not in that into politics.
Me, honestly speaking, I have not been interested in these political things. I know nothing about the constitution. I don't want to lie.
Even though Article 37 talks about that freedom, I don't know what's there to like about the constitution if it's not being followed.
The part that I like in the Kenyan Constitution 2010 is the Bill of Rights.
One thing that I like so much about the Kenyan Constitution, and actually this is something that I came to know when the Maandamano started, I think it's a word that not so many Kenyans knew before, picketing.
Well, I'm going to cede, respectfully, the term normally used to describe me and ask you, Mwalimu, would you like to comment on the comment?
Certainly. First of all, let me say, it's nothing wrong, you know, with not being interested in politics and not having read the Constitution. I can't blame somebody for that. I sort of regret it, but many, many, many people in every country will never have read the Constitution, but they may have some sense of what it is. Like the second or the third person, the lady who said Article 27, I think, this is about equality. She's absolutely right, and it was really nice to know somebody understands that. Very sad, of course, that she thinks this is really an irrelevance because nobody's taking any notice of it. I think that it's really important that we actually do take notice of the Constitution, because it only becomes a reality if people, including the people, not the politicians, take it seriously. So I was enheartened by the gentleman who said the Bill of Rights was the thing that he took most seriously about the Constitution, and amused by the one who said he'd learnt a new word from it. On the whole, one of the good things about the Constitution, perhaps, is that as far as laws go, it's probably easier to understand than many. But, of course, the word picketing was not there just to expand people's vocabulary. But still, interesting that at least he's aware that that is in the Constitution. One imagines that he's aware of a good deal else as well.
Well, this is one of those conversations where there's not going to be enough time to address everything. The topic is vast. But I'm going to come back to you on the idea of what you think we should you like best and what we all should celebrate in this constitution, time permitting. But since this is a retrospective discussion, I would like to go back to the past, if I may, and say 60 years. Now, for my generation, I go back to Lancaster House and their pictures of people sort of in traditional regalia, politicians sort of carrying cockerels and going off to London and coming back. And the, let's call it the coffee house conversation says, this was a horrible constitution given us by the horrible white man going against our traditions. Well, is there something to be said for constitutionalism? When did it begin? And is it, by its nature, un-African?
I'm not sure how one would put a date to the word constitutionalism. But I think the idea of constitutionalism goes back a very long way. Because the idea that people should be governed not by what, you know, the ruler thought when he got out of bed on a particular side that morning, but on the basis of something fairly understandable and hopefully not changing day by day. Constitutionalism is usually used to refer to having a constitution and an expectation that that constitution will be, by and large, followed or at least taken seriously. Not that I'm sure every constitution has failures, but so it's an old idea. I'm not sure that the actual word is so old.
If I may, is it too? Why isn't there one constitution for the whole world? Why can't we have a one-size-fits-all? Because if you have religious tracts, I mean, the Bible, for those who believe, is the word of God and pertains to anybody who's a Christian. So why don't we have the same constitution everywhere?
Some people have proposed that, I think. But then other people say, look, actually, a constitution is a bit of a history of a country, that it reflects what's in the constitution is there because people felt there was something needing to be done that hadn't been done perhaps in the past. It's not always so apparent, but it certainly is the case in Kenya that we can look at some of the provisions of the constitution and we say, yes, we know why that is there, and that's because of what's happened to us in the past.
Okay, I'm going to go back to Lancaster House. Enlighten me. To your mind, what happened and what did we end up leaving? And then why the first change? Why did we see a need to change a brand new constitution, which we had accepted as we went into independence? Kenya flag flying, you know, fireworks. We've all got those images.
Yes, Lancaster House was a rather elegant building in London where many countries have negotiated, or their representatives have negotiated with the British over the terms of their independence, particularly the constitution. So it's by no means restricted to Kenya. It's not just Lancaster, it's Lancaster House, just a single building, but a rather, as I say, rather elegant one. We had actually three Lancaster House conferences. The first was in 1960, then there was one in 62, and then the final one in the last months before independence in 1963. And the idea was to iron out progressively the issues about how the government should run and issues like a Bill of Rights before independence actually happened. At the time when the first discussions took place, I think it wasn't even clear exactly when independence would take place, although it was obviously not far, not in the really distant future.
Okay, so we go back to the idea is I'm using the gathering, the masses are in throng and in thrall, and they're saying it was a bad colonial imposition, and that's why all our problems began from there. And that's why maybe the government of the time, the government of Jomo Kenyatta, saw it fit to change the constitution. Would you tell us what they saw fit to change first? Because we have this wonderful thing, Mwalimu, where we will say, when did the rain start beating us? Do you have any idea when the rain started beating us constitutionally?
I think that the constitution was destined to be changed even before it was passed. Negotiations at Lancaster House and around Lancaster House, because they weren't only at Lancaster House, focused on a number of issues. Let me take just one example. That was the question of what was then called Majimbo, and what we essentially now call devolution. The one issue was that there were two. There was KANU, of course, everybody knew, Kenya African National Union. But there was also KADU, which was composed largely of smaller ethnic groups.
Kenya African Democratic Union.
Exactly.
Got it, yes. Right.
And they didn't agree at Lancaster House. So actually, at least two of the conferences at Lancaster House ended up with the British actually making a number of the decisions. The last one, the British by that time desperate to get out and were by that time it seemed to be enthusiastically supporting Jomo Kenyatta as the first Prime Minister, as he became. Any changes they made were leaning towards his preferences rather than KADU. But KADU was very keen on a system of regional government. And the British, not the British government so much as the white settlers, were also rather keen on that.
Well, you raise an issue there. This conversation can never be exhausted because we go back to this whole thing of did we fight for our independence? Was blood shed? But there could be fisticuffs across the land if we go there. I want to go back, Mwalimu, to this idea of what was changed first. Because I'm going to give you fair warning. My through line in this conversation is that this constitutionalism isn't working for us, and perhaps culturally we're not ready for it. So I want you to know where I'm coming from, as the Americans like to say, but tell us when we started changing things.
I think that they were probably planning it even before it was passed. As you said, Kenya became independent on the 12th of December 1963, and the first act of Parliament to change the constitution was passed during 1964 and was fully passed by Parliament, signed by the President, by the end of November 1964, with a provision in it that said this comes into effect on the 12th of December 1964. And two things that stand out from that act. The first one was that until then, Kenya had continued to be part of the dominions of the crown. The head of state was the queen, represented in the country by the governor general. From the 12th of December 1964, it became a republic. And the person who had been prime minister, Jomo Kenyatta, became the president. He retained, in a sense, all the powers of a prime minister as head of government and all the powers of a head of state, so all rolled into one. And that from that day on, we had a sort of presidential system of government. The other thing that happened on the 12th of December 1964 was the beginning of unpacking and demolishing the system of regional government, which Kenyatta had never wanted.
Right. Well, I think we're going to come back. It's 18:44, time for our first break. Thank you very much. Mwalimu Mwenzangu, I would like you to continue with that sort of history lesson. I'm going to indulge you. What happened next? We're now, nobody wants Majimboism. What next in terms of change? Because, again, we don't have enough time, but we're going to get to the point where Kenya is going to become a one-party state. We're going to get to the point where there you can sort of be picked up and detention without trial. Explain.
Yes, I mean, in fact, as I said, some of these changes were foreshadowed even before the Constitution came into its original form. I understand that, for example, Jaramogi Odinga actually said, well, there's no need to have more than one party. And indeed, even before Kenya became legally a one-party state, which was not for quite so long time, first of all, KADU gradually sort of was merged into KANU. And so it became, in effect, a one-party state, not so very long after independence. You said nobody wanted Majimbo, but obviously some people had wanted Majimbo, but the ruling party didn't. And they got what they wanted. And in those days, Parliament was extremely subservient to the head of government, or the president. And basically, they got what they wanted through Parliament. And so over the next few years, there were two acts, in fact, even in 1964, two acts and two in each of the following years, I think, roughly 65, 66, 66. So that even by 1969, quite a number of changes had taken place. Over the years, apart from the ones that we have mentioned, at one point, the independence of the judiciary was undermined because they no longer had their ability to stay in office. Even if they displeased the government, they could be got rid of easily, and sometimes were. What seemed to happen was that if the government didn't like something in the constitution, rather than saying, can we make the most of this? This is our fundamental law. They said, let's change the constitution. And one particular example was when there was a provision in the constitution that an MP who'd been convicted of a criminal offence of a certain severity lost their seat. And the president didn't want a particular individual to lose his seat. So they changed the constitution so the president could pardon somebody and remove that disqualification from them. So, and I think at one point, the retiring age from judges was changed just because they wanted a particular individual to remain for longer. So that's why by 2010, the chief judges retired at the rather odd age of 74. So there was a whole whittling away of the constitution over the years.
And also this idea, because what I'm getting at is that the very heartwarming words that the constitution belongs to the people, and I don't know whether I want you to fall on your sword at some point, but the people haven't had any say in the fact that, for example, you get to a stage where people have to queue vote. So we got to a stage where if you wanted to have somebody in Parliament or vote for anybody, you stood in a line, everybody saw which line you were standing in, which was a bit sort of exposing, to put it mildly, where if the constitution is made by the people, how did we get to a point where we're all happily queuing up behind someone for everybody to see without this idea of a secret ballot?
Well, people have often commented that the original constitution, and I think the its replacement in 1969, were not made by the people. So
that's naught out of 10 for Africa generally as a continent.
Well,
it has not only for Kenya, but elsewhere.
Yeah.
There are instances where what's on the what's in the mind, what's the ideal, is not being replicated by reality.
It's, well, the Constitution, I think, probably didn't even pretend to really be the voice of the people, unlike the current Constitution, which talks immediately about the sovereignty of the people, and where it would not be possible to have the 1988, I think it was, queuing system, because it makes it very clear that elections have to be by secret ballot.
Okay. I'd also like you to draw you on this idea of, at one point, one of the problems that we have, constitutionalism for Africa, this idea of ethnicity and tribalism, we've moved on, and that could be a next section. Did it, in the rhetoric and the syntax of a European culture, address our biggest problem, which is the idea is that there, you know, so many people brought together as a nation who weren't each other's best neighbours to begin with? How from a legal point of view, can this be addressed?
Well, it is a very difficult, that going back to the European element, isn't it not true that that colonialism made the ethnic relations worse?
Yes, I dare say.
So you would not necessarily expect them to be very focused on dealing with the problem that they had, to a considerable extent, created both by the way in which they drew boundaries in African countries, and then by the way they governed in a way that was as classically described as divide and rule. There was an element in the way in which Kenya, the Majimbo system was set up. Boundaries were drawn and so on during the colonial period, and that had an ethnic element to it. And in other words, it was felt, well, you had to give these people their own little pockets of country where they could exercise their own decisions and so on, and maybe keeping them out of each other's hair.
Well, I'm going to come back to that, but before, another explanation, if we take this as preamble time. I, as a representative of One Aichi Everywhere that I claim to be, I'm much exercised by this phrase, the rule of law. Now, again, we've got our laws, they're regulating away, and it seems to me that anybody, anywhere, can set up a law that obliges the citizenry to follow it. And they might not like it. They weren't in parliament to create the law in any way. So what at any given time represents the rule of law? And then we'll move on from that, from what's happening now in the present day. Because everybody's saying, the rule of law, we've got to respect the rule of law, none of this is happening. The other side is saying, if you come out there and demonstrate again, we're going to deal with you because you're disrespecting the rule of law. So what is the rule of law? And should the citizen, by rights, respect it in any way?
Mm-hmm. I think it's another phrase that just changed its meaning to some extent and in a sense expanded its meaning over the years. Originally, yes, it did mean exactly what it said. There should be laws to govern people's behaviour. The sense that people should understand what the law is, or should have a way of understanding what the law is, so that the rule was not entirely arbitrary, random, and so on. But then people began to realise that you could, as you say, you could have things that were formally law, properly made as law, and yet were completely unacceptable. The Nazi rule in Germany in the 1930s generated a lot of debate about this because they actually used the law to back up their policies. Rule of law has developed a rather broader concept, as well as meaning government should be by law and therefore rules should be understood and followed, is also the idea that those rules should be reasonable. The law doesn't mean just any old law. It actually means a just and reasonable law.
Right. So if you would, let's fast forward to the present. And we have this whole notion of the rule of law. And let's not name names. I call a demonstration. I call for mano a mano. And I say it's going to be a peaceful demonstration. And then all my followers go and sort of burn the odd mosque and destroy the odd thing. And then I call in the police with live bullets and shoot some people, and they die. So I'm saying, long preamble, we don't seem to have traveled that far in the 60 years to celebrate this wonderful birthday. We're still shooting people, and the people that we're shooting are invoking that they have the right to do what they're doing, and the government is saying they don't have the right. They shouldn't disrupt the smooth running of society and destroy industry and business. So again, it's the constitution that's either deficient or responsible for our mess.
The constitution certainly does not give any mandate for the people to protest in a violent fashion. In fact, it has the right, recognizes the right to demonstrate and to picket.
Yes.
And to
By the way, what is to picket? I'm not so sure. I could probably go picketing tomorrow. What is to picket?
I most associate the word with people who go on strike. And then sort of have people posted outside places of work to say to the workers, you should be on strike, don't go. But it can be used in other situations where you sort of stand outside a building and you're making a protest of some sort. It's a sort of standing around obstructing in a peaceful way, not violently,
right,
but just trying to push yourself forward so people know you have a point to make.
Well, Imu, we've got 3 minutes for you to answer the next question before the break. I will still draw you as a legal expert on this issue of who is in the right, the person, because by definition, the government in power, the status quo, represents the law, and the people are saying we're fed up with this. Mm-hmm. Should they be going out and picketing and demonstrating when they've chosen the government that's subjugating them at the time? Do you see my little sort of confusion? Mm-hmm. And there's a lovely word, there's this document, the Constitution, hovering about. Could you deal with that in 2 minutes, maybe?
Oh dear.
And we can continue thereafter, but we have to take a break.
Okay. People, even the most democratically elected governments, can make mistakes or do things that people disapprove of. And it really is important that it should be possible to express one's views. But they always ought to be in a peaceful manner, and the law should not obstruct them from protesting in a peaceful way. I'll stop there for the moment.
Right, we'll take a break. So, Walimu, here we are. Let me come back with the gun sort of blazing. I would like you to comment on how it seems to me that the past is coming back to haunt us. And would you comment on that? We've done the era, the Mulolongo, and we're doing exactly the same thing in 2023. Or aren't we doing exactly the same thing? Have we moved forward?
I think the past has big influences on what happens in the present, yes. I think that what happened way back in 1964 when the government started to dismantle the constitution, not to remove the constitution, but to change it to the way it wanted, I suspect has had an impact on people's regard for constitutions as a source of stability.
They're cynical about it, in a word.
I think they may be cynical about it, yes. Secondly, I think one of the problems that has come down to us from the last few generations has been this notion of the all-powerful president. And it very much affects the way government views the role of president and of government, and to some extent the way people think about the role of president. And they somehow think that presidents have a sort of God-given amount of power, and that trying to limit that can sometimes be viewed as an interference with the natural functions of a president. It worries me sometimes.
Right. Well, I'm going to play barrackroom constitutional lawyer, if you would, and I'm going to bring out some key words that represent what we did civics, I think, in my day, civics, and we sort of, the government was to be divided into, still looking at 60 years, still looking at this significant birthday, the three arms of government, the executive, the legislature, and the judiciary. And the idea, maybe my civics teacher was all wrong, was that they were to be entirely independent of each other. Is that becoming closer to pertaining in 2023 than it was in 1963? The separation of powers,
Of powers, yes. Which, funnily enough, doesn't figure much as a phrase in our constitution. Many systems of government don't have separation of powers than others. It never meant complete separation. Of course, they have to interact with each other. In some countries, they interact more. In the United Kingdom, the head of government is a member of parliament, and all the ministers have to be members of parliament. That is not the case here, and it's not the case, for example, in the United States. The idea, however, is that certain functions should be performed by certain bodies with the experience and the powers to do what is necessary, but also that by carrying out their functions, they are checking the others. So that nobody grabs all the power into their own hands and runs away with it. So one body makes the law, and another group of people run the government in the narrow sense, that is the ministers and the president or whatever he's called. And then the judiciary is not part of either of the others, and has the function of taking complaints among others against the government, and the power to decide, if necessary, that government is overstepping its mark.
Well, Mwalimu, I'm not going to come back on you on these because there's lots to cover, but I will give you a heads up, thinking on your chair, of the other bullet points that I've got. Then we'll rattle them off because we've got 15 minutes. I've got devolution, the rule of law I've sort of ticked off, gender equity, integrity, human rights, salaries and remuneration, independence of the judiciary, which you've mentioned, land commission, environmental rights, and freedom of the media. So I'm going to go to devolution. And again, Majimbo in the 1960s, is it true to say, as a layman, that the idea that the national government still controls how much money the county government is going to get and withholds it to a point where perhaps now we can't pay salaries, 60 years later, it's not working. Devolution is not working. Mwalimu?
I think there are serious problems with devolution. But I still think it's one of the important aspects of the Constitution. The fact is that in many countries, governments, local level governments, second level governments, do not manage to raise a huge amount of money for themselves. I think in Nigeria, for example, that's particularly the case, except these oil-rich areas. So it's not at all uncommon that a good deal of the money does come from the national government. We have had a particular problem of delays by the national treasury into the counties. It's not supposed to happen. The constitution imagines that the money will be paid fairly regularly. So there is a serious problem there. And of course, there are problems, as people have said, we have devolved corruption. It was naive, I think, for some people involved in making the constitution did believe that corruption would be much less at the local level because people would be in a position to watch what their closer government was doing. It hasn't always worked.
Gender equity, the notion that, you know, let's not get into definitions here, but that the idea that we should have representations of the human race in comparable measure. It's not happening because it's still a highly conservative male society 60 years on.
I think that a lot has actually changed. True, at the national government level, we still fall well short of having representatives, particularly in the National Assembly, that the minimum, supposed to be a sort of minimum functional level of one-third women. We haven't got there yet. We're not far off it in the Senate. It is actually required by the Constitution for county assemblies. But an awful lot of other bodies have got reasonable levels of women. Commissions and so on. Again, governments have not been very good at that, especially the national government, in having necessarily no more than two-thirds of either gender, which is what the constitution says, in the cabinet, for example. And of course, one of the classic examples has been the cabinet administrative secretaries, who are overwhelmingly male. But I do think actually more has changed, including attitudes and expectations, than you might imagine.
Onwards. Integrity. The idea that the great mass of our leaders are men and women of integrity is, to me, risible. Mwalimu?
Yes. It's hard to disagree with that. And Chapter 6, which was supposed to change things, has been a bit of a disappointment. There's one crucial error in the language, I think, of Chapter 6, which says that there's a principle: people should be appointed on the basis of integrity or free and fair elections, which suggests that somehow for people who are being elected, all that's necessary is that they are elected and not, it doesn't matter if they don't have the integrity, which I think is unfortunate. And I think that it hasn't been taken seriously enough by those who appoint other people. The courts have perhaps not always been as imaginative and positive as they might have been. They rejected a suggestion that I think was derived from a case in India that at least MPs, candidates to be elected representatives, should be required by law to disclose if they have any criminal cases against them. And there have been one or two other cases in which arguments about people not being qualified because of their dubious record have been rejected. It's not that chapter has not worked as well as one would have hoped.
Human rights, Mwalimu. Bodies floating on the Yala River. Mwalimu?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
What have we? Record 9 mark out of 10? 60 years on?
That would be very difficult to...
always remembering that our... Not you, Mwalimu, but... What is my sort of side question is, what is the new constitution doing to make things better than they were?
I think the new constitution has made a difference because people are, they may not know much of the detail, but they are much more aware of it. A constitution does nothing by itself. It's not an engine. It doesn't move without people saying, I want to use the constitution for this purpose. And people have used the constitution a good deal for purposes of enforcing human rights. And of course, not all the bodies that have are supposed to be there to protect our human rights have always done the jobs to their fullest capacity. I think that's true. Yet I do think that on the whole, there is a greater awareness and a greater commitment on the part of the people, if not those in power, to see a better Kenya as a result of the constitution.
Thank you, Mwalimu. I'm going with 5 minutes to do some. I'll talk some bullet points. Salaries and remuneration, and brand new cars for the boys and girls. Let's have as many positions, cabinet secretaries. Let there be 50 of them. All my mates are in there. Good thing, Mwalimu?
Well, I think that may still be challenged because the Public Service Commission recommended only 23 of them. So the CAS is, so maybe that's something that will yet come before the courts. As far as extravagant lifestyles is concerned, we have the Salaries and Remuneration Commission, much resented by MPs who have constantly trying to find ways of giving themselves more money, despite the fact that their terms and conditions of service are supposed to be fixed by the Salaries and Remuneration Commission. The other public servants are sometimes subject to recommendation by the Salaries and Remuneration Commission. I personally think it has been unfortunate that whereas we all realise that the country is hard up. And yet the people who still seem to not lose out, although they've lost out for the last month for having their salaries delayed, but they're not going to lose their salaries, those people are not giving a lead on treating the financial situation seriously.
We've got time for one more bullet point before the next break, and the last one. Independence of the judiciary, headline, our judiciary is corrupt and buyable. If you've got the money, you'll go off scot-free.
I am sure there are cases in which that is true. I cannot deny it. I do think that the judiciary is very much better than it used to be before the current constitution. For various reasons, the constitution is part of it, but it's certain individuals and a certain self-respect on the part of the judiciary is also part of it.
Right, one more. We're doing well. The Land Commission. This, I think, was the Ndungu report. I knew Mr. Ndungu. I think that's the man who came and said, OK, we've got all these iniquities about the way land is being distributed in this country. And then in our recent headlines, we've got this idea of people walking into a farm and walking off with 1,500 dopers and burning down trees. Two things. You're picking on a family that is already well known to all as being extremely rich. Could one not argue that the people are reclaiming their rights by walking in and taking a doper each? Assuming that there are 47 million of them to be taken.
Two quick things. One is the Constitution can't stop the criminally minded. And it can't stop people stirring up people with resentment. But it is, I think, unfortunate that when the Constitution contemplated dealing with historic land injustices, that has never really been carried through.
Okay, well, thank you very much. That's the time for the final break, and then we've got two more bullet points, and then we'll find out who you are.
Bring together a deceased billionaire's fortune, dark family secret, and two families that dislike each other, and all gloves are off.
Start your life here. It's not enough for me. It's just not enough.
This is the plot of Second Family, an original telenovela streaming exclusively on Showmax.
You don't know what they do to girls like you.
I think it's a Venian affair.
Sign up at Showmax.com and watch the drama unfold in a battle of wealth, power, and revenge.
That's a novel!
This production stars Ian Bogwa, Nick Deda, Sarah Wajiko, John C.B. Okumu, Charles Aouda, and many more. Tune into The Jam with June and Martin to learn more.
Radioactive with So Soft. Leave your clothes feeling nice and soft with every So Soft wash. So Soft, tender loving care. Radioactive every weekday from 2 p.m. to 3 p.m. for your best mix of music right here on Capital FM. Radioactive with So Soft. Leave your clothes feeling nice and soft with every So Soft wash. So Soft, tender loving care. Previously on Legal Insider.
This is actually a question, all right?
Mm-hmm.
About somebody asking, their father actually passed on, and a month later, the uncles want the land and to sell the land, claim to the property. That's quite common. It's happening in Kenya, in Africa. Mm. So is this lawful?
It's a proper offense under the Act, intermeddling with the deceased estates. It's fineable 10,000 or 1 year in jail or both. In that particular scenario, there's a very strict list of priorities in terms of who is entitled to inherit the assets of a deceased. And I can assure you, the uncles are very, very far in that pecking order.
Really?
We start with the spouses, we go to siblings, we go to the father, the mother, creditors. By the time you get to uncles, that's you remember how far. Even stepsisters, half-brothers, and so on.
Yeah.
Legal Insider, every Thursday, 6:30 p.m. to 7:30 p.m. The law is an ass. Make sure it doesn't bite yours. Get a deeper understanding of legal issues. And if you're good, free legal consultation with Nick and Data.
Mwalimu, may we talk about the Constitution 60 years on and environmental rights, which I'm going to link up to the whole idea of conservation, animals. So here are our captions. In so many years' time, Lake Victoria will be so polluted that there won't be a single tilapia in sight, much to my chagrin. That's my national dish. There'll be no lions, no elephants. How are we doing on that score in terms of legislation and the regulation?
I suspect that we've got quite a lot of law. It's not really a shortage of law. A shortage of willingness to take the law seriously. A shortage of resources, perhaps, for the agencies that are supposed to enforce that law. I think one of the things one has to remember, as I said, about a constitution, it doesn't do anything by itself. We have a book and that you may have seen somewhere called Constitution, an Instrument of Change. And I think that's what it is. It is an instrument. And we cannot really hold the constitution responsible for what people don't use it for. But some people have used the constitution to very good effect for some environmental cases.
Okay, the last bullet point for me is freedom of the media. Now, the caption here, what one hears about, is it's very easy for the government in power, not naming governments, to simply muzzle the media or to threaten journalists, so that although outwardly there may be a semblance of freedom of the press, in reality it's controlled to a measure where it doesn't exist, really.
I think it probably exists here rather more than it does in some other countries, but there has been a lot of concern about the freedom of the media recently. And again, some cases have come before the courts, and the courts have upheld the freedom of speech, but not always. It doesn't include only the formal media, the newspapers and so on. It also includes social media. So it is a cause of concern, and maybe more could be done. Again, reading the Constitution itself, it's fairly strong on the subject of independence of, well, freedom of media and freedom of expression generally, with reasonable exceptions that are not limited to Kenya.
Right. So, Mwalimu, I think to come to a close in terms of our discussion, let's go full circle. And my apologies, I have been sort of playing devil's advocate, but as a member of the press, I guess that's part of my job. I'd like you, as a final comment, to say, if we're thinking about our constitution and its changes 60 years on, what would you, as a legal scholar, say are things that we ought to be justly proud of? Successes. Let's end on a high.
You seem to have gone through quite a lot of the Constitution in your questions. I actually do believe that in many respects devolution has made a difference. I think it has promise. It's difficult and of course does need more money. I think the Bill of Rights has made a difference. I think there have been extraordinary numbers of cases brought before the courts. And what is really necessary is for people to pick up on the decisions that have been made and insist on these things in everyday life, really, and in work and in politics. We need a more active citizenry, and I think we need to educate people more about the Constitution. But we have the basis here for a much better Kenya, and one I still think is better than it was before the 2010 Constitution.
May I ask you a personal question as a Mwalimu myself? Education is key. How, it's all very well to say educate people. We came back to the vox pops at the beginning where people were saying, I'm not interested. And you were very kind, you were very accommodating in saying it's not entirely necessary. But if the people don't know, they can't all be legal scholars like yourself, but if we don't really know what our constitution guarantees us, how can we act upon it come election time, for example?
Yes, I think we could do much more to educate people about the Constitution.
Should the government be doing it? Should it be in the classrooms? Should it be... Because we both know the Kenya we know and love. Go to all these places. Go to Marsabit, go to Wajir, go to Pokot, go to Samburu. They're people with very disparate day-to-day experiences. And if I'm experiencing drought, for example, for 3 years in a row, I'm really not that interested in Article 27 of the Constitution.
No. But maybe there are other things that you might be interested in, including the responsibility of the government, because you have a right to water and a right to access, to reasonable access to food and so on. Maybe it's not always for the individuals. There are provisions in the Constitution which make it possible for even those not affected by situations to go to court and try and enforce the Constitution. But of course, it's not just a question of going to court. It is a question of, in a sense, believing in the Constitution and insisting on one's rights. I'm not sure the government is the right body to teach us about the Constitution, although they could do more. I wish that we could have somehow a movement of educating the population about the Constitution in a way they understand and relates to their everyday lives.
May I ask who you are?
My name is Jill Cottrell Guy.
Ah, Jill Cottrell Guy. Now, our listeners are saying, any relation to another guy of our national conscience?
I am the wife of Yashpal Guy. I do not have the word guy on my passport because we married rather late in life and I had gone through a whole career using my maiden name. But for the last few years, I have tended to use both names.
Okay, so constitutional lawyer, I'd like for you to tell something about how you, and dare I say it, as a woman, I hope you don't find that sexist, how you rose to what you became within the law. What was the inspiration? Did Daddy tell you to become a lawyer? Was Mummy a lawyer? How did it all come about?
No, is the answer to your question. I didn't know very much about the professions and as a schoolgirl, but my friends were all going to university. I originally thought I would study history, which is my favourite subject, and then, in a way I cannot now remember, I decided that maybe law would be interesting. There was one other girl from my school who had ever done law, and she left the school the year I joined it. So I knew very little about studying law or studying anything else. I went to university and discovered there were all sorts of other fascinating subjects. So I would say to young people, do explore the possibilities and the range of things, whether it's education or other careers or jobs, that you may not be aware of. So I studied, and then partly I became a law teacher because I came to Africa. And one of the ways of traveling overseas was to do it as a teacher. And I spent my first two jobs were in Nigeria. Teaching law.
Because the constitutional law was the word that we were using from the beginning, or the two words that we were using. What has been your experience in that particular specified, you know, like a doctor saying, I'm a neurosurgeon and I'm a urologist? I mean, what are the particular pleasures to be derived from constitutional law, especially Walimu, when we said there are as many constitutions as there are planets?
I had not had a particular interest in constitutional law. I have a long association with Yash Guy, who's always been a specialist in constitutional law. And gradually I got more involved and began, sometimes we would go to countries together to work on the constitution, or I would go with him if he were working. So I owe a very great deal to being married to one of Kenya's most distinguished constitutional lawyers. And I'm not ashamed of saying that.
Okay, well, neither did I suggest that you might be, no. But I'd like one more word. You're a role model. That's another thing that's used in these things, the role model. Now, let's take gender aside. What would you do to encourage young people to become what you've become? And what would you encourage them to do? Read legal texts, read a novel a week, watch television. What's the path?
I'm not sure I'm a role model. I don't deserve to be thought of as a role model. But advising young people, I do think they should read, almost read anything, because whatever you read expands your horizons. And believe that you can achieve maybe some things, not things you anticipate achieving, but have faith in yourself and constantly look to the future.
Right. I will let it stay there. It's just past 19 hours, 28 minutes and 41 seconds, and time to stop. Do continue to give us feedback, hopefully positive and reassuring, on the Twitter handle at Capital FM Kenya, or drop us a line or text or WhatsApp message on 0701 984 984. I've been talking to Jill Cottrell Guy, constitutional lawyer and current chairperson of the Katiba Institute, which is dedicated rather to safeguarding our constitution. And you've been listening to John Sibiokumu on Wednesday. Thank you for doing that. Much obliged. Until next time.